Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin.
My guest today is Bradley Wright, an associate professor of sociology at the University of Connecticut and a frequent guest here on our show, clocking in at 4 appearances with today's interview, putting him in pretty rarefied air. Professor Wright specializes and has written broadly in the sociology of religion, the sociology of crime, as well as the subfield of social psychology. Brad is the author of 2 great books that have been featured on our program, Christians Are Hate-Filled Hypocrites and Other Lies You've Been Told, and Upside, Surprising Good News About the State of Our World. He also is in the midst of a long-term, broad-based project known as Soul Pulse that investigates how religiosity affects individual behavior and emotions on a daily basis using a very novel online technology. It's kind of like a spiritual Fitbit, but with a social scientific twist. That project was the topic of our 200th episode last year, and we will discuss some of the new findings in that study a little bit later in the program, as well as how you can get involved and participate in that study. But he is back here today to talk about an extremely interesting and counterintuitive study on how various churches respond to inquiries from different racial groups. I had the opportunity to talk with Brad about this study at a conference in Boston recently, and his article on this study that he co-authored with several other scholars will be published in just a few weeks in the Journal for the Scientific Study of Religion. But we are excited to be bringing it to you here first. Well, actually, second, because Christianity Today featured the results of the study back in late June of this year, but we are the first ones to bring it to you in podcast form. Ha! There you go. I should note that Professor Wright also ruminates about many topics related to religion and social life over at his own website, brewright.com, which you can find linked at our website. Brad, it's always a pleasure to have you on Research on Religion. You're one of my favorite guests.
Well, thank you, Tony. I appreciate that. And just so you know, this has now become one of my main motivations for doing research is trying to get number 5.
That's right. I mentioned you are in rarefied air, and we were talking about who sets the records here on this podcast. And I think Rod Stark, James Felak, and Jeremy Lott actually have more appearances than you, but you're rapidly catching up with them. So,
yeah, I'm going to go online anonymously and start dissing those other researchers,
yeah,
trying to slow them down a little bit. I don't know if that'll work. But
Or you could just do what you know we intend you to do, is just conduct more great research, and we'll get you.
Oh, that's right. That would probably be easier.
Yeah, that's the more kind of Christian-loving kind of way of doing it, too. So, but that anonymity always works. So, all right. Today, we got a couple things we want to do. We want to talk about the recent developments in Soul Pulse, because I think that's neat. I participated in the study, and I might have to do it once again. That's for later in the program. What I'm really interested in right now is this new study that you conducted entitled Religion, Race, and Discrimination, a Field Experiment of How American Churches Welcome Newcomers. First, let's start out by listing all your various co-authors, because we want to give them credit, and there's a lot of folks involved in this project. So who are they all?
Oh my goodness, I don't even know if I can do this from memory. There's so many. My main collaborator for field experiments is Mike Wallace, a professor here at UConn. And then we worked with 4 grad students, and I'll put them in alphabetical order: Christopher Donnelly, Stacy Mazzari, Annie Scola Wisniewski, and Christine Zozula. So 6 altogether. The form for JSSR, the journal we're publishing it in, only allowed for 5 co-authors. I had to send an email saying, oh, don't forget number 6.
Hmm. Who is number 6?
One of the grad students I just mentioned.
Oh, okay. Oh, yeah, there are 6 there.
Yeah.
Oh, so they have a limit of 5 people.
Well, their form, because I just guess they don't think anybody would want to go up to 6, but This research goes up to 6. How's that?
Okay. So that's a lot of people. That's not quite like the physicist who list about 25 different people. I'm sure their forms will accommodate more than 5 authors. But 6 for sociologists and any other social scientist, it's getting up there. So how is it working with all those folks? So how did you divide up the work and everything?
Well, that's the thing with this study, Tony, is that it involved an incredible amount of work. And for reasons I still don't understand, I didn't go apply for a grant for it. It would have been great for a grant. So what I had to do is sweet talk people into working in it, promising them great fame and rewards in exchange for just countless hours of tedious menial work. And part of what I promised them was co-authorships. Mm-hmm. And so we were very lucky. We had 4 smart, talented grad students who were willing to help us. And as we'll discuss later in the podcast, the volume of details we had to manage was just incredible. And so that's why we had so many people.
And I'm glad that you're giving them credit as co-authors, because a lot of times we think of the authors as the people who come up with the big ideas and then who tippity-tap things on the typewriter to get it on paper. But as you mentioned, a lot of tedious work. Research is a lot of grunt work. It's not all glamorous lab coats and blowing things up. But it's going door to door, calling people back or emailing people back as it might be, and entering things into databases that, you do sit there for 8 hours on end doing that kind of stuff. And it again seems meaningless, but it's incredibly important in the long run.
And also, these grad students shaped the intellectual flavor of it. So it wasn't just scut work. And so I really appreciated working with them. Unfortunately, all of them have graduated from our program. So that was a loss.
But they went on to bigger and better things, I would assume.
Yes.
Oh, excellent. So you said they influenced the intellectual flavor. How so?
We had weekly meetings for about a year on this project, and we talked about everything from the smallest detail of how to handle one particular church to how do we want to frame the issue, and everywhere in between. And just having 6 people talk about it got us a lot further than having 1 or 2.
Yeah, that is another very cool thing about this study, is that you're getting a lot of different ideas into the mix. It's not just one person, headbutting this thing all the way through. But oftentimes we see some of our own biases by talking to other folks. And so having 6 folks in here is a really nice mix. So you're interested in testing to see whether or not churches exhibit discriminatory behavior. That's the broad umbrella topic right here. How did you get into that topic, and what was the specific motivating question there?
It actually flowed out of my first book. So my first book, Christians Are Hate-Filled Hypocrites and Other Lies You've Been Told, concluded with the idea, or a summary, that Christians are doing well in many areas. But one area, especially evangelical Christians, where we might be having trouble, is race relations. So I thought, as a follow-up study, I would explore that further. And I wanted to communicate to both the scholarly community and Christians in the church that more needs to be done here. And so I was fishing around for a research method that would have some vividness to it, that would be something other than just chasing variables around my regression equations from the GSS. I've been interested in, I've been doing field experiments for a while, and so what this study is bringing together field experiment techniques with the issue of race and religion.
You talk about field experiment techniques. So what is this field experiment thing for folks who don't know about it?
I don't have any field experiments going on right now. It's just the coolest method. I just love it. Mm-hmm. You do an experiment in real life. So you get the validity of an experiment where you randomly manipulate something, which psychologists like to do in labs, and you do it in real life. So you're talking about real behavior, not necessarily just lab behavior, which may or may not generalize to real behavior, or behavior in the real world, I should say.
So how did you set this up for your study? Again, the big motivating question is, are different religious denominations welcoming to people of different racial categories? Mm-hmm. So that's the big question. But how are you going to study that on a field experiment?
We spent a lot of time trying to figure that out. And my goal was to somehow get the church somehow we needed to get churches to respond to different people of different races and ethnicities. So one thing we could have done, we didn't do, but we could have done, was actually hire people of different races and ethnicities to go to churches and record their experiences and send them around the country. That seemed a little expensive.
Yeah.
So what we did instead was we sent emails to churches and saying, hey, I'm moving to your community. Could you give me some information? And it's a little more elaborated than that. And then we randomly assigned how the name sounded, because sometimes some names sound white. Brad Wright, for example, mm-hmm. is a very white-sounding name. Some names sound Hispanic, Jose Garcia. Some sound African-American. Some sound Asian. And by doing this, we basically created virtual people to see how churches would respond to them.
And there's some precedent for this type of research, right?
Oh, yes, of course. We got the idea from, I got it from a study, Jamal and Letitia, that was the Jamal and Letitia study that was done by economists at, I think, MIT in Chicago, where they sent out job applications, and they had white-sounding names and black-sounding names, and they found that just having a black-sounding name reduced callbacks from employers by about a third.
And so you're going to do this for churches, and you're sending out emails, and what do you write in the email?
You know, we spent so much time trying to figure that out. So what would you say? You know, what would an average person say? So what we did is I ended up asking about 20, 30 different Christians, hey, if you're moving to a new community, what would you, and you sent an email ahead of time, what would you say? And I got the idea actually from my pastor who periodically would get emails like this from people who wanted to visit.
Hmm.
And so let me read you the wording of what we ended up with.
Okay.
We wanted kind of a nondescript email that didn't have a lot of, that asked for information, but didn't really convey a lot about the person, because we wanted to emphasize the name. Dear Pastor, my family and I are moving to your area in several months. We're looking for a new church to attend, and we're hoping to get some information about your church. We'd like to find a church similar to the one we regularly attend now. So would you please let me know how big your congregation is, your service times, and any additional information that is helpful. Thank you very much, comma.
Mm-hmm.
So every church got that email.
Now, that sounds pretty simple. There's some asking some basic information, and not very long, too, because long emails, nobody wants to read long emails, so keep it one or two sentences.
There's actually an acronym, TLDR, too long didn't read, that I have seen people use when they get too long of an email, they just send back TLDR.
Yeah. I didn't know that. I'm going to have to use that now. I have to admit, I am an abuser of the TLDRs, that I write very long emails. And so I now that explains what I get these responses back. Anyways, but so, okay, so the email is very simple, asking for some basic information, right? And this email is the same for every single church, but what you vary is the name on the bottom of the email. And yeah. how did you go about picking the names? You mentioned that, well, some names sound very ethnic, Jose Garcia, for instance. Was there a meeting where you said, okay, where can we get the most ethnic-sounding name? I mean, that'd be an interesting meeting to be sitting in.
Yes, we ended up looking at other studies that have done this. So we're not the first people here, so we might as well learn from them. We looked at census data, where they look at race and ethnicity by name. So there's some names that sound more, you know, white, black, Hispanic, Asian than others. So, for example, I would assume, and I don't know if this is true, but I would assume there's more African-Americans named John than there are African-Americans named Jamal. Mm-hmm. But Jamal is more unique to African-Americans. So it's those unique names we were looking for. And we ended up with eight. We had two names for each racial or ethnic group. For whites, it was Scott Taylor or Greg Murphy. For blacks, it was Jamal Washington and Tyrone Jefferson. Hispanics, Carlos Garcia and Jose Hernandez. And Asians, Wen Lang Lee and Jong Soo Kim.
Okay.
And so we spent a lot of time researching these and then talking to people in these different groups and said, if you saw this name, what would you think? Or just talking to people in general.
Okay. So you're scouting out the names a little bit. You got these, and they do. They sound very distinct and unique. And I think from my perspective too, I get emails from students all the time, and you see a name that's, you know, sounding Asian. You say, well, this is probably an Asian person, right? So that embeds that in your mind. So it seems pretty good. The next step is, in addition to get some responses, you want to figure out what the responses were. And we'll get to the measurement of how you gauge the responses from the different pastors. But the next step is, once you write the email, once you put in the names, you have to send out these emails to a set of churches. So you have to do this. You have to pick a bunch of churches to send to. Now, before we get to that, I have a question, because this somewhat amazes me that you're able to do this. And I want to talk a little bit about the ethics of this study. And it gets into the ethics of field research. You're sending an email to somebody saying, hey, I'm moving to your town. What's your church like? How big? When's your service times? What other information? But you're not really intending to move to their town. And so there seems to be a little bit of deception here. Social scientists in the past have gotten in trouble doing some deceptive research on individuals. So how did you get permission to do this study? If you could talk a little bit about what we in academia call the Internal Review Board, or Human Subjects Division. Instruct us a little bit about that and the ethics of this study.
Well, so the Internal Review Board goes through all the research that is done by faculty at the university, or I guess any researcher, and gauges whether or not it's ethical. And this protects the university, also protects society, because sometimes we researchers get kind of crazy ideas and aren't helpful and actually hurt people.
Oh, yeah.
And we also, here at UConn at least, have to go through training every year or two about what it means to do ethical research and stuff like that. At the heart of the IRB decision, the Internal Review Board, is a cost-benefit analysis. So basically, do the benefits far outweigh the costs of a study? So let's say you and I were psychology professors and we wanted to shanghai some undergraduates for our study of looking at perception or something. Mm-hmm. And we give them extra credit to do it. IRB would say, well, is the benefits, the extra credit, outweigh the cost, you know, some of their time? Is there any way they're going to be emotionally damaged, physically damaged, and so forth? For ours, and we have a great IRB board here, we're very thankful for that. The cost for each church, and Tony, let me just say, the only reason it seems like we lied to 3,000 churches is because we lied to 3,000 churches. That's the only reason it seems that way.
Okay.
So we sent fictitious, deceitful, as you might put it, emails to 3,100 churches. And the reason why this was deemed ethical, and I think it is that all we're asking for is an email response. We're not asking for any time or commitment beyond that. Also, and this is a subtle thing, and we can pick it up later, we can't possibly identify any church as racist. Mm-hmm. This design does not allow for that. Yeah. We can only see it in the aggregate.
Right. So that becomes an important part, how you present the results, is very important as well.
So the costs are pretty minimal. We're just asking for an email. And the benefits are substantial. So if we identify strata of social organizations in our society that are probably inadvertently turning away people who are not white, that's actually pretty important information. We can make society, you know, a little bit better because of that. So it was deemed, and pretty straightforwardly, that this was ethical from that approach.
So no problems from the IRB?
No, they were great.
Excellent.
And they helped us think through several, there's a couple sticky things that they helped walk us through, and we're very fortunate with the IRB here.
Yeah, you are very blessed to have an IRB like that. Not all universities are like that, and it kind of depends upon, some universities have had histories of faculty getting in trouble with a variety of different studies, and they have to really go through things with a fine-tooth comb, sometimes to the point of just slowing the research down to the point where you don't want to do it. But you have been fortunate in doing this, and I wouldn't call it deceitful. So I would say it's a misrepresentation, right? Deceitful sounds malevolent, like you're trying to intentionally hurt somebody. And so I want to give more credit to your study than others might be out there and saying, yeah, this is a procedure that seems to be used. And again, the reporting of it No individual church is identified as being, oh, you're the really mean, nasty people or such like that. So the reporting of this becomes very important as well. Okay, so you get this study certified with a green light for go, and the next step is that you send out those emails. So how do you get the sample? Where do you go to?
That was actually a clever idea, and I'm going to take full credit for it because I don't have that many really clever ideas. This happened to be one of them. So my thought is, you know, on the rare occasions it happens, people are going to hear about it. We got a list of congressional districts, and we sorted it, and congressional districts sorted by population density. So I think Alaska is the least dense in terms of population, and New York, you know, like Manhattan, is the most dense. And we took like every seventh one. And so that enabled us to get a random sample of congressional districts. And so that meant we were able to get all types of communities, or all types of places. Within those places, we looked for multiple churches from 12 different denominational groups. We picked 5 different mainline groups, 6 different evangelical, and then Catholic churches. And so we got multiple ones of those so that we could send, you know, say, I don't think we had Iowa City in our sample, but say we had drawn the congressional district that Iowa City's in, we'd pick the town closest to the center of the district. Then we would find multiple Catholic churches in Iowa City, multiple American Baptist churches, multiple Southern Baptist, multiple Evangelical Lutheran, Presbyterian, Methodist, Episcopalian, and then a couple other categories as well.
And where did you get those lists of churches? Do you look it up, yellowpages.com or something like that? Did you use any other database?
That's kind of fun. Yeah. Some churches, some denominations have directories. Yeah. So if you want to find Presbyterian PCUSA church in your community, just go to PCUSA and type in your zip code, and they'll tell you the nearest churches.
Oh, kind of like Dunkin' Donuts does.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Oh, I like that.
You might even get donuts when you go there.
Yeah, well, yeah, of course you do at churches. Yeah.
So similarity continues. Those are the best. We also tried to get unaffiliated evangelical churches, like community churches. Mm-hmm. And for that, we would just Google, and then we'd go to the website. Or so we'd Google the name of churches, and then go to the website and, you know, just look through how they describe themselves and try to eyeball whether or not we thought they were evangelical.
Mm-hmm. And that seems like a pretty good method there. I'm sure there's some churches that you couldn't get to because they, you know, are almost basically small Bible study groups and really fly under the radar, might not have their own website. But, you know, in terms of comprehensiveness, this is a very good study there.
Yeah, and most churches are concerned about their public presentation, so they'll have websites.
Okay.
But you're right, there are some churches who we would have missed from this.
And then in terms of picking the churches, the different denominations, you're looking at Christian churches. You didn't do any Jewish or Muslim denominations, did you?
That's correct.
Okay.
In part because we couldn't think of a letter that would apply to them as well.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, so that's fair. And did you aim to get roughly the same proportion of denominations that's in the general population, or did you skew the sample one way or the other?
We tried to get about the same proportion. So we looked at the top 5 or 6. We took the top most populated or biggest mainline denominations, and we did it also with the evangelical denominations. And our goal really was to compare mainline versus evangelical versus Catholic. Although, I'll give you a little spoiler alert, we didn't get enough Catholic churches.
Uh-oh.
One-twelfth of our sample was Catholic churches, but if we were going to compare mainline, which is 5/12 versus evangelical, which is 6/12 versus Catholic, which is 1/12, we really should have had more Catholic churches. So it probably should have been like 5/12 to 5/12 to 2/12, or, you know, add another condition or something.
Well, as our social scientists always say, that's for future research.
Right? Yeah, there you go.
Yeah, next study,
future
right?
Funding. Yeah. That's my new thing.
Exactly.
Future funding and research.
Need more funding. Crank up that Catholic sample there a little bit. Actually, one other question I had when you found those folks on the website or you saw emails, and I know if you go to some churches are really small and there will be one person that you email to, but some churches can be really big and there will be, you know, director of finance and a director of youth ministry and things like that. Was there a particular individual or type of person that you were looking for to send this email to? Was it the lead pastor? Was there a welcoming committee email on some of these larger churches?
That's a great question. We contacted the churches as they instructed us to on their website.
Okay.
So most churches will publicize how they wanted to be contacted. You know, so it could be like info at sttonys.com.
Okay.
Or contact this elder or something like that. So we followed their lead and sent it to where they told us to.
Yeah, and that's important because sometimes you will email something to somebody who it's not my job to do that, and they won't get back. And that leads me to that next question about the response rate. Right? This is something that for survey research is always a big question that's out there, and many people, especially in the popular media, gloss over, is that some people don't respond. And if certain people don't respond and it's systematic why they're not responding, it can have an impact on the study. So looking at the response rate is always important. How is your response rate?
We actually got really lucky. We had about 58% of the churches responded to us. Now, we did not want 100% response rates, because if we did, we couldn't distinguish variation in response rates. And we didn't want a zero, or we didn't want a very high or a very low. We wanted somewhere in the middle. And we got it. We got 59%.
So that becomes an interesting question here, is that you didn't want 100% response rate. And that sounds a little bit odd, because you say, well, you want everybody to answer back. Why did you want some non-responses?
Great question. Because that's how we distinguish the denominations.
Mm.
So if one denomination has several hundred churches in it that we send emails to, the way we characterize that denomination is by what percentage of its churches responded. And if every denomination had 100% respond, then there's no meaning, there's no information in it for us. And so our primary dependent variable, as we researchers like to call it, or outcome, is how many churches responded within a group, and then how did they respond if they did respond. So both quantity of responses and quality.
Yeah, so non-response is not mean no information. There's information contained in that, and that can be
exactly.
Very important. The other thing that researchers will do in terms of response rates is to send callback, or they used to call them callbacks when they did it by phone, and many people still do phone surveys, but I guess this would be an email back. Did you do any repeated attempts if you hadn't heard in, say a week or so?
No, because really, we got the information we wanted with the first response or not.
Okay.
But what we did do is a little bit the mirror image of that is we recorded which churches contacted us multiple times. Because some churches, we get an email from the pastor and then from the deacon and then from the person of the bell choir or whatever. And so we record, they responded three times. And that felt different than the churches that only responded once, which felt a lot different than churches that didn't respond at all.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I'm going to have to ask about this a little bit more. I guess I kind of glanced over this in your study, and I read through it. I thought pretty closely, but multiple responses, say from the choir director. Wow, that is like, hey, this person sent us an email. Let's not let this person go. In fact, even if they're thinking of not moving out here to South Carolina and their job is in Boston, we're going to drive up to Boston and bring them back down here.
Exactly.
So, yeah, no, that seems like a really, really welcoming church. All right, so we're getting closer to the results now. We're setting up the study. We've created the question. We've put in the names. We've sent these out from the sample that you generated.
Let me add another little twist.
Yeah.
How did we record the responses?
That's my next question. It's a measurement issue.
As if I could outthink your question.
I know.
When we sent out the email, and we'd learned this in previous field experiments, so this is like my fourth or fifth field experiment, and I started starting to pick up the potential problems, because I made most of the mistakes previously. And that is, sometimes churches will reply, and you don't know who they're replying to. So they'll just send, they'll reply, but they'll cut out the initial email, and they won't address the person. So if we had just one email account for all six or all eight names, we could just get an email saying, yeah, we'd love to have you come, see you on Sunday. And we wouldn't know who they're talking to. So each person, each of the eight character or each of the eight names got their own email address. Now, here's kind of a little methodological twist. It's possible that the name of the email account might evoke different response rates.
Wow, you are really fine-tuning this. I hadn't thought about this, but that's a really good point.
Right?
Yeah.
Because, you know, is it the Jamal Washington? Is it the name, or was it the name of his email account? So we ended up with email accounts that were like abbreviations and numbers. So I forget the exact abbreviation, but say it's ABC. So it'd be like ABC72 at whatever the carrier was .com. And one was 71, 72, 73, 74, 75, 76. And we spent a whole, this wonderful research session talking about, are some numbers more appealing than others? So we didn't want to have small numbers like 7, because 7 is kind of a cool number.
It is.
Where 6, less cool. And I apologize to all the 6s out there. But 7, that's a cool number.
7 is a lucky number.
And so we went up with like 71 through 79, figuring, I don't know, if people have strong feelings about things in the 70s. So anyway, just a little fine-tuned methodology.
Yeah, this wasn't in the report. I want to point this out to our listeners how, again, you know, fine-grained the thought is on this process here of just the email itself, the email address might evoke some kind of image or something like that. The other thing too, and I was wondering about this, is do some emails tend to get sorted into the junk mail? And I have this problem with students all the time. All of our students at the University of Washington get their official university account, and it has the, you know, UW@EDU logo or address assigned to it. But sometimes students don't use that, and they'll come with all these different types of carriers. And I know there was one time I got from a student, it was fairytales.com or something like that. And I you know, you see that email pop up in your box, and you're like, oh, this has got to be junk mail or spam. I'm not going to respond to it, or you're less likely to respond. The subject line did catch my eye, but again, it's trying to catch somebody's eye. And is an ABC123 almost looks like one of those come buy insurance with our company and emails that could easily be shunted off to a junk mail box. And
absolutely. That's right. With the subject line, we had one or two research meetings about what to put in a subject line. We ended up with visiting your church because we thought that might bypass some of the informal spam filters, you know, as people look at it. But your question about people not responding is important, because people, we can think of several, maybe 4 or 5 general categories of reactions to our emails. It could be that the church never got it, right? So it got lost somewhere in cyberspace. Or it could be they got it, but they never really read it or intended to it, right? So I have emails in my account where I'm pretty sure I never read them, and they just sort of get lost into get pushed down further and further in my inbox, and eventually I forget about them. Or it could be that churches never respond to these kinds of emails. It could be from, you know, the President of the United States or the Pope or anybody. They're just not going to respond. Or it could be they respond to everybody. They have somebody say, everything you get, respond to. So those are all categories where every church is going to act the same regardless of what we say. So what that tells us is that of that 59% of responses that we got, that left 41% that people did not respond. They did not respond for a variety of reasons.
Yeah, I have to clarify. What you said is that every church is going to respond the same. What you're actually saying is you're assuming that there will be an equal distribution across denominations of those 4 or 5 different reasons they didn't answer.
That's true, but more importantly, across treatments.
Yeah.
So across names.
Right.
So that's the thing we really care about.
Okay. Yeah. So not all churches are going to be doing that, but you assume that, you know, a Catholic church is not going to be any different than a Presbyterian church when it comes to filtering junk mail.
Well, they might be.
Okay.
rather we assume that whether you get one from Jamal or Carlos or Wen Langley or Scott, you're not going to be, that's not going to affect how you sort junk mail that you don't read.
Yeah.
But that means that of those 41%, some of those are just, they're not meaningful. Rather, yeah, they're a function of the church's system, not what we sent.
Exactly.
So, and this is a subtle point. I don't know if I can convey it well, but that actually removes some of the non-responses, which magnify the responses, which means we probably have underestimated the amount of racism that we found.
Okay. Very important result here. So, that said, there you're talking a lot about non-response, and you have to really be careful about measuring that and specifying what you think is going on there. But there then are the responses. And how do you categorize the responses?
Well, when the responses came in, first of all, we just categorized whether or not they sent something. So 1-0. Then we categorized whether it was the first time they responded or second or third. A couple churches signed us up for their mailing list, and we counted that as one response, but not like the 28 that we had to delete.
It's somewhat of a welcoming response, but it also is, you can almost see it as an auto response. Anytime somebody sends something, automatically sign them up for the Sunday sermon podcast or whatever.
So we did that, and that's all we were going to do to start with.
Okay.
But then we started reading through the emails, and we realized, first of all, the churches were really nice. Most of them were really nice to our fictitious movers. But we realized there's a lot of variation in the emails. So then we started categorizing how they responded. So, for example, how many words did they use? Was there a greeting? Did they refer to us by our last name or our first name? So was it, hey, Tony, or was it, hello, Mr. Gill?
Mm-hmm.
So we started looking at the quality of the research, and that's where we needed the grad students, because we had to read and code every single last email. And that took forever.
How many were there? How many? I mean, you mentioned the response rate of, I think, was 58%, but how many in total was that? 100,000?
58% of 3,100 is how many churches we got replied. So was that like 1,800?
1,800,
but
yeah.
But then some churches replied multiple times.
Wow.
So we're probably up to 2,500 emails we had to read and code.
Boo.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's more than the number of emails I get the day before an exam. Yeah, that's a lot of emails. One of the other questions I was wondering too, and when I read these studies, I try to create the study in my head. Okay, this is how I would do it as a basis for evaluating that. Did you think about days to respond? Did some people respond within 5 minutes or versus 5 days? I mean, there could be...
We did that.
Okay.
We actually thought about whether to do it by hours, but we thought that was going a little too far. But yeah, we did time to response.
And I have to go back on the sample, too. This was across the United States, right?
Yeah, this is Alaska and Texas and New York and Mississippi and California and all sorts of places.
Yeah, so you don't want to do hours to response, because then you got to start thinking about time zones. And us folks out here on the West Coast, I get emails at 5 in the morning saying, why aren't you responding to me? Because it's 5 in the morning here. It's your work day there, but, you know, hey. Okay, so days to respond, length of the word count. So you count it up, the amount of words, whether it was first name, last name. Was there any qualitative reading into the warmth of it? I mean, you can almost tell sometimes somebody's sending you a boilerplate response, and then other people are like, oh my gosh, somebody contacted me. I want to reach out and talk to you about, you know, your life experience and stuff. I mean, that's a much different response. What was the kind of the qualitative measure of this?
Well, thankfully, the grad students that we brought on board were all qualitative students, and so they were experts at this. So they read through it, and after countless meetings, we ended up with 5 categories. The warmth of the message, as you just mentioned. How much they sold the church. Because some churches say, here's the information. Others are, hey, here's the information. We're really a good church. If you move to this area, you'll want to think about us. The quality of the information. So we asked several specific questions. Did they answer them? Also, religious closing. So some churches would say, you know, blessings to you, or, you know, some sort of almost like a little benediction at the end.
Yeah.
And then how we worship. Some, even though we didn't ask about it, some churches would go into how they worship and why they do it. And so those were the five or six categories that we ended up with in terms of qualitative analysis.
And I thought that was really cool when I was reading. You described that very well in the study that when I saw religious closing, I had never thought about that, right? One of these things that says, you know, blessings to you rather than sincerely. I mean, that's two different responses there. If I'm looking for a church, I want the blessings or may God be with you rather than, you know, sincerely. Sincerely sounds like I'm applying to an accounting firm.
Exactly.
Right? You know, but
exactly.
Blessing sounds like we want to come in and give you a big spiritual hug kind of thing.
Yep.
Okay. So you got all that, and had many multiple meetings about that. So now we're getting to the results. But again, before we get to the results, and the results are really cool in the study, as I mentioned, there are some counterintuitive results here. You have to have some theoretical priors going into the study. Something is informing this in the background. You're not just doing a pure fishing expedition. So tell us about the theory, or at least the theoretical ideas that are swimming around in the back of the study.
Okay. Yeah, it's there's a lot of thinking about why, first of all, there's the observation that in churches across America, people look like each other in terms of race and ethnicity. So most churches that you walk into, if the first person you see is white, most other people will be, or Hispanic or black or Asian. So researchers in the past have called this homophily, that we want to be around people who are similar to us. You know, so imagine a party, and you know all the old folks sit gather together, and all the young folks do, and all the parents with little kids do. They all sit at the same table. That's mostly within a party. Same thing happens with Christianity, where people find churches that have other people who are similar to them, especially smaller churches. So I go to a church now where there's lots of people who are contractors. So there's a lot of kind of high-end blue-collar people, and they have sort of found each other. And so that happens in churches, and there's various reasons for this. One, we're just attracted to being around people like us. You know, so that's been called the big sort of we want to be around people who are similar. Also, churches as a growth strategy reach out to certain types of people. So you might have also, like in one town locally, there's the church that's the family church, that they aim at families. So if you have kids, you want to go there because they have nurseries, they have vacation Bible school, they have youth groups, they have all these great programs. And so those are two of the drivers for homophily.
Yeah, I wanted to mention that issue about churches seeking out similar people, because again, some people could read this as malicious. We only want people that are just like us and we don't like the other or the outsider. But on the other hand, that's how churches grow. It's the friends and family approach, right? The way you get more recruits is to talk to somebody who's already in your church and say, hey, do you know somebody? And you're likely to know somebody who shares the same interests that you do. I know, as you mentioned, you're in a neighborhood with a lot of, high-end blue-collar contractors. We're in a neighborhood that likes people living out in the country. Right. And so we all tend to like country music or drive trucks or something like that. We the big sort, as you say.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
And now this doesn't have to do with the study per se, but there's an interesting disconnection between Christian theology and Christian practice. So Christian theology is very inclusive, go to all nations. And, the New Testament talks about reaching Jews and Greeks and so forth. But organizationally, if you want a church to grow, find your market niche. If you're in a big city, aim for motocross riders or foodies or hipsters or whatever. And so you have effective practices of organizations which tend to be homophily or homogeneity or get people who are similar versus Christian theology, which is diversity. And so there's a lot written by Michael Emerson and other people about this and how to overcome it and create diverse growing organizations. And it's not easy.
I can imagine not. So that's factoring into the study here. What about the theoretical priors regarding the denominations?
So in addition to just expecting that Christian churches as a whole would respond differently by race and ethnicity, we looked at Catholic churches, mainline Protestant churches, and especially evangelicals. And as I mentioned, part of my motivation for this study was to demonstrate to evangelicals that we're not doing a good job with welcoming people from different races and ethnicities. At least that's what I thought I was going to do. So we read widely about these three different Christian traditions, and mainline Protestants have a deep, rich history of advocacy for racial diversity and equality. So, you know, they're very involved in the civil rights movement in the 60s, and even now, you know, the local mainline churches all have, you know, welcome and affirming or open to all or, you know, rainbow or whatever on their signs to demonstrate, hey, we want everybody here. It doesn't matter what you look like. Evangelical churches, however, they have some of that, but their emphasis on justice, as it were, isn't so much organizational, it's more interpersonal. Basically, whoever I'm with, I'll love. And so we found a literature on structural versus interpersonal justice. So if we wanted to survey people and ask, should there be affirmative action by race? So a structural solution, a potential structural solution to racial inequality in education. Mainline Protestants are a lot more likely to say yes than evangelicals. But evangelicals spend a lot of time talking about how we need to reach out one-to-one, you know, like personal evangelism or, you know, connect to the person next to you. And they'll say, with structural things, love can't be legislated. So you have two sort of visions of racial justice, one at the structural or societal level, and one at the interpersonal level, or, you know, the person whose hands you're shaking. And then Catholics are a bit in the middle, because in Catholicism, there's a bit of a tradition, or there's a tradition of going to the parish that's nearest you. And so to the extent that neighborhoods are similar, that parish will be similar, but often parishes will span different types of neighborhoods. So when I was growing up, I was raised Catholic. You know, we were in a parish that had a lot of Hispanics, because the Hispanic neighborhoods were on the other side of the parish from where we lived.
Mm-hmm. And so everybody just goes to the closest one. Some come from the east side, some from the west side, and you all end up in the same mix.
Exactly. So our expectations were that our hypothesis, first hypothesis, was that churches in general would vary their responses by race and ethnicity. And then our second hypothesis was that mainline Protestant churches would be less welcoming than evangelical, because what we're measuring is one-to-one interpersonal behavior, not sort of structural theory or attitudes.
Mm-hmm. And so what did you find?
Well, this is what makes it such a funny paper. Have you ever heard the expression, that's why they play the game in sports?
Yeah.
You know, it's like, well, we didn't expect this upset. And they say, well, that's why you play the game, because you don't know the outcome.
That's right, because the Seattle Seahawks are projected to be in the Super Bowl this year. So I said, let's just skip the season and just give us the trophy. But no,
exactly.
They got it.
Exactly.
Yeah,
I got it. Well, you have to run in from the one before you get the trophy, and that may be difficult. But I was astonished by the findings, because basically, in a very nice, loving, thoughtful way, I was trying to set a trap for evangelicals.
Mm-hmm.
And not to make them look bad, but to say, hey, we can do better. Right? Because my first book was mainly about how a lot of things are going, evangelicals are doing really well in many areas of Christianity, but except for race. So I thought, I will demonstrate in a very vivid way. And what a great story it would have been if I had found that evangelicals weren't welcoming of blacks, Hispanics, and Asians, because then I could have said, hey, we want to grow, but look, we're shooting ourselves in the feet. But the evangelicals didn't discriminate.
Ah.
I was astonished. I actually ran the analysis multiple times because I just didn't believe it.
Yeah.
Because there's so much in the research literature about evangelicals and discrimination. It's like, in a mystery, if there's a butler on the scene, they're the ones who committed the murder.
Mm-hmm.
In a paper on race and religion, if the word evangelicals in the abstract, they're the ones who are discriminating or who are prejudiced. But that's because previous days have focused on survey data, which get at structural justice. Instead, we found they didn't discriminate. But there was discrimination. It was the mainline Protestant churches, which it never occurred to me that would happen. So for all the resolutions passed at national conferences, for all the signs that say open and affirming to all, For all the little things at the bottom of bulletins that say, we welcome all members of all races and ethnicities or whatever, they overall were substantially less welcoming of racial and ethnic minorities. To put some numbers to it, for every 100 emails that were sent to whites by mainline Protestant churches, 85 were sent to blacks and Hispanics, and only 70 Asian. So think about that, Tony. Just putting an Asian name on an email reduced a church's interest by 30%.
Now let me...
Just two words.
Yeah, I wanted to ask about the cross racial divide too, and you just got to this. And as I was reading this too, I mean, this could be an indication of racial discrimination. Somebody could read very strongly into this study and say, well, this is racism. But there also might be other things. When the Asian result popped up, that mainline Protestants were less likely to respond to Asians, I was wondering if one possible interpretation would be that, oh, you know, this person has an Asian sounding name, they probably speak Korean or Chinese, and man, we just don't have the resources here to deal with that. We would love to serve them, but we don't, and so we don't respond. I mean, is that a possible read into this?
Oh, absolutely. In fact, I would make the same read.
Yeah.
But that's still discrimination.
It turns out
discrimination comes in different flavors. And that kind of thinking is called statistical discrimination. So let me give you some other examples of it. We shouldn't hire women as firefighters because they're not strong enough. Well, there's plenty of women who are strong enough, even if women overall aren't as physically strong as men. Or someone saying, we shouldn't have girls in science because they're not as good at science, or something like that. Where you just make assumptions about a group's abilities. So I would assume that for most pastors, it wasn't, oh, we don't like blacks, Hispanics, Asians. Rather, I would assume that it was maybe picking up unconscious biases, or if they thought about it explicitly, then it was, you know, we're a small church, they probably wouldn't fit in. You know, so we're a small church, we're mostly old and white. What are we going to do with a young Korean family?
Yeah.
No, that's still discrimination.
Mm-hmm.
It's not the malevolent, torches at night discrimination.
Right.
It's still discrimination.
Yeah. Oh, so that's really interesting findings that you did there. Did you see any variation by regions of the country? I mean, you could break the U.S. down to Northeast, South, Midwest, West, and, you know, of course, all us folks out here in the Western United States are just huggy and welcoming. So did you find any regional variation, or did you even look for it?
The Barney States.
Yeah, the Barney States.
I love you. You love me. We're a happy family.
Yeah.
Centered in Portland, I believe.
Yes, exactly.
We actually did. And are you ready?
This is
a Research on Religion exclusive. I haven't put this anywhere else because it's not in the paper.
Okay.
But it was mainly in the Midwest and Southern states that we found discrimination.
Mm.
Not so much in the Northeast or the West.
Okay.
And we're holding that back because somewhere in the back of our mind, we're thinking of doing a place paper because not only are these churches in different denominations, they're in different places.
Mm-hmm.
Some are in big cities, some are in small, some are in the left coast, some are in the south. Some are in places that are racially mixed, some are not. Cause, you know, we have the zip code they're in.
Yeah.
So there is regional variation, yes.
And that's, again, for listeners out there, this is, you know, a regular practice in academia, what we call the least publishable unit, that you don't want to give away all your findings because, you know, each finding could be a publication on your vita, and that's always important.
Well, and also, we have so many findings already in this paper.
Yeah.
We really had trouble fitting into the page limit.
And so I'm kind of asking, again, for a little bit of exclusive here. Did you find any difference between urban and rural?
No, we did not look at that.
Okay.
We don't have that coded in our data set. It would be easy to do.
Okay.
We just have to match up urban and rural data to the zip code. We just haven't done that yet.
Okay. So that's for a future podcast, I would assume.
Yep.
You're just holding that because...
Oh, number five.
Oh, number five. Exactly.
Now motivated. What can I say?
So some very good stuff here. What are any other observations that you had from your study that is in the published report that you want to share with us that you found surprising or interesting?
Well, first of all, so the mainlines did it. That was surprising. Also, it was more against Asians than against blacks and Hispanics, and that was surprising. Often, issues of discrimination and race boil down to white versus black. But there are more Hispanics in the United States than there are blacks, and Asians are 5% of the population. And so I think it's much a much richer story. And this study shows the importance of looking at multiple racial and ethnic minority groups. So we didn't expect that at all, but we came to the same conclusion that you did, that it was a language issue, because language is so important with church. Another set of findings that kind of surprised us is that the qualitative data matched the quantitative data set, or findings, in that when it was mainline Protestant churches who responded less often, and when they did respond, it was less warm, there were fewer words, there was fewer religious salutations, it was just a different response. In fact, we noticed that about 1 in 20, maybe 1 in 30 responses are what we call terse responses. So it's something along the lines of, go to our website. Or there's no thank yous, there's no pleases, there's no dears, just the information you want on our website. Or we meet at 10. That's it. And mainline Protestants were substantially more likely to do that for whites, or to do that, to give such terse, almost rude responses to minorities than they were whites. So I guess that was the last sort of surprise, is that it's in what people said, not just if they said.
Now, I want to finish up with this question before we move on to Soul Pulse, and that is the response to this study. It is being published by the Journal for the Scientific Study of Religion, so it's been through the peer review process. It's been sifted out at conferences, and people have nosed through the results and the data and the procedures and stuff, so you've gone the gauntlet of the academic route. But you also published this in Christianity Today a few months ago. What kind of response did you get from that?
Less than I would have thought. Hmm. Because it came out the same week that the Supreme Court ruled on gay marriage.
So you were just washed over in news, in other news.
It's like a tsunami.
Yeah, yeah.
And I thought we'd be like a prominent news story in religion news that mm-hmm. week, and there was just nothing. So we're actually, the university's prepared some press for it. They decided to hold off until it comes out in JSSR and then try it and hope it's a quieter media.
Okay. Yeah.
But when people have responded, it's sort of under the heading of, oh, that's kind of interesting. I think some evangelicals are encouraged. I'm hoping that this shakes things up a little bit for mainline Protestants. I'm not sure that they'll get to it. It's really easy with things like this, Tony, to think, oh, everybody else is doing it, just not me. And that's not to say all mainline Protestants discriminate. In fact, we got a number of warm, thoughtful, kind letters from mainline Protestant churches. But they did have people who did have churches who were less inclined to respond because they were racial minorities. So I'm hoping it makes a little bit of a noise there, that a little bit more push to extend ideas of justice into interpersonal interactions rather than structural, into handshakes, not rather than just statements.
Well, I want to encourage you by telling you that this study did catch my attention when it popped up on my Christianity Today news feed. And in fact, it might have been, I was just so tired of all the other news that this was a refreshing thing, saying, oh, okay, here's something I can grab onto. It seems like some rather encouraging news in many respects. And so it was a nice piece, and I'm glad to have you on in terms of this. Let me go ahead now and finish up with this other thing that you're doing called Soul Pulse. And in about 5 minutes here to close up, if you could tell us or remind us, because we have a previous podcast with you that we will link to, just remind us what Soul Pulse is and how people can get involved, and then also what you're finding out of this thing.
Okay, so Soul Pulse is, I did field experiments for 5 or 6 years. Soul Pulse is my next thing, and that's what I'm doing now. And Soul Pulse is this really cool study. It's ongoing, and you can find it at soulpulse.org, so S-O-U-L, pulse, P-U-L-S-E.org. And what it does is it allows people, anyone who wants to in the country, who has a smartphone, to go to that site, sign up, and then for 2 weeks, you get 2 text-messaged surveys a day at different times, and they ask about how you're doing spiritually, how you're doing emotionally, what's going on, who are you with, what's the weather outside like, all sorts of interesting information about your life at that moment. Then at the end of the study, at the end of the participants' 2 weeks involvement, then we keep the data, and then we create this nice summary report with cool graphs about what their life was like. So when did they feel closest to God or higher power or a higher ideal? When did they feel most loving towards others? When did they feel most peaceful? So it's almost like, well, like you said at the start, it's like a Fitbit for the soul is what the report is like. We've enrolled about 4,000 people over the last year and a half, and so that's just wonderful. It's produced about 1 million pieces of information, and so we're in the process of analyzing it. I have a team of about 12 researchers who are working on it, and in fact, we just had one of our papers presented at the ASA meetings, and we looked at awareness of God and how it varies by situation. And the findings are it's astonishing how much our spiritual awareness varies by situation. It's higher in the morning than in the evening. It's higher on Saturdays and Sundays than it is during the week. And it's higher by type of activity. So it's really high when you're praying or meditating, as you'd expect. But it turns out to be pretty low when you're in front of a computer screen or a TV screen. So anything, any kind of electronic screen is when our spirituality is lowest, or our perceived sense of spirituality. And it's also pretty high when you're doing road activities, like preparing food or going for a walk or something like that. Now, that's kind of interesting because I think of society moving us more towards electronics and further away from preparing food or walking places. So it's kind of interesting to think how larger social changes might affect it. Here's a cool finding. And I'm going to get a little technical, and I apologize if I lose people. And this, it took me forever to get my head around this. With some things, the type of person who does it would evoke one effect, but actually doing it would have another effect. Here's the example. The kinds of people who watch the news on television or listen to it on the radio have higher levels of spiritual awareness than those who don't. But the actual act of watching it lowers spiritual awareness for everybody. So, if you turn on the TV, if you're watching TV and you're watching the news, your spiritual awareness will be lower than it is when you're not watching the news. But the kind of people who turn on the TV and watch the news have higher spiritual awareness. So it's kind of a cool, you know, goes in two different directions effect.
Yeah. No, that is kind of interesting. So what you're saying is that there's a larger variation in spirituality for TV news watchers. They're highly spiritual when they're away from the tube, but once they turn it on, it goes drops pretty fast.
It drops for everyone.
Yeah.
So people who turn it on are higher.
Yeah.
Anyone who turns it on gets lower when they watch.
Okay.
So it's a person versus situation distinction.
Yeah. Ooh, very cool interaction effect there.
Yeah. Exactly.
Excellent. Well, I want to send people to the website because they can enroll in the study, and it's fun. I have done it. It doesn't hurt. It's actually pretty interesting, and it's fun too. I have to admit, I'm one of these people that loves taking surveys because I've been in the survey methodology world a bit, and you have this little sliding bar that you can move back and forth on your smartphone to rate how you're feeling at any given moment in time. And the questions are a bit randomized; they're not always the same questions that come up, so it's always a surprise when you get the text message. So, folks, I urge you to go out to soulpulse.org and check it out. Sign up for the study, and it is fun. And you're helping out the academic community learn about the world that we're in. And what could be better than that? I don't know.
Yeah, you know, we're taking surveys when people are in their world rather than pulling them on out of the world into our offices or onto the phone or something.
Yeah. So folks, join into that. And that, we're going to have to check back on you because you've been here 4 times, but I definitely can see a 5th or 6th episode with you coming along because, as I mentioned, you're one of my favorite sociologists of religion, and I want to thank you, Brad Wright, for being on Research on Religion again.
Oh, always a pleasure, Tony, and I look forward to seeing you at the next conference, too.
You got it.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.